Welcome to the Adam Stattmiller podcast. This is Adam Stattmiller, and I am your fearless host today with another of our interview series. Today, I am excited to have a professor, is it professor? Mm-hmm. Professor Austin Choi. He's the Austin Choi Fitzpatrick, excuse me. He's assistant professor at the School of Peace Studies at USD. Welcome to the, I call it a show, but it's just you and me with an iPhone, but we'll call it a show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's you, me, and an iPhone and a cup of coffee.
And a cup
that makes it a show.
Yeah. Most definitely. Well, Austin and I met at a school function for our daughter. You have a daughter and I have a daughter. How many kids you got?
Two daughters.
Two daughters and a wife, obviously. Myself as well. I have two daughters, so we're in the same camp. What ages?
9 and 6.
Okay, so I'm kind of in that world.
And I'm not telling you what my wife's age is.
Yeah.
She might listen.
Well, I'm 9, I'm 8 and 13, so I've got the teenage thing going on. It's a little bit different. But we went to a pre-school barbecue for all the new parents, which was really interesting. It was almost like a meeting of the UN because there was, I don't know how many, most people were from overseas because of the whole UCSD contingent that is up there. Are you new to the area?
Yeah, we're new. We moved here from Hungary about 8 weeks ago.
Okay.
And before Hungary, we're in East Africa.
Wow. Just give us a quick, what were you doing in Hungary and East Africa?
So I work, I'm a scholar, and I do work on human rights and social movements. And my wife does work on international development and health and this sort of education, this sort of thing. So we moved to East Africa a number of years ago, where she was the director of a sort of countrywide director for a program that had school feeding programs across the country. And it had 70, 80,000 beneficiaries, sort of children in schools across the country. And while we lived there, I did my sort of field work for my dissertation in India. And so I went back and forth between Tanzania and India and interviewed human rights violators, which we can talk about if you're interested in that. And then we also, so then I finished that, took a degree, and we moved to Europe, where I was a professor at a university there, at an American graduate school in Budapest.
What was your PhD? What was your doctorate?
Sociology.
Sociology. Yeah. Oh, wow. And so just the whole concept of sociology, or I mean, what was your basic premise of?
Yeah, so I do work on social movements and human rights and social change.
So did you study, what was the one you studied, or what did you study for your dissertation?
So for the dissertation, I actually focused on a particular sort of human rights violation in India, in rural India, which is bonded labor, which is a form of, of contemporary slavery. Exactly.
Right. Big for Christians these days.
Yeah, exactly. It
big
is.
Big thought
it
for
certainly,
Christians.
It certainly is.
And when did that hit the Christian radar, by the way?
Hit the Christian radar in the about the same time.
Besides the abolition movement.
Yeah, it was late 1700s. Yeah. Thanks for asking. Right?
But it's been renewed. It went dormant. Didn't it not go dormant for a while after, you know, the slaves in America got free and we forgot about it? Is that what happened?
That's what happened. There was a brief spurt of attention in the early 1900s around the panic that there were white women being trafficked into slavery. And
God forbid, trafficking a white person.
That was exactly what everyone said at the time. And so there was a white slave trade fear that sort of struck a number of communities, but evangelicals as well. And who got involved in droves, and everybody sort of generally...
Give me some names. Is there any names you can think of people that were...
No, not off the top of my head. Okay. No. We'll put some links up if we'll shoot some stuff to that afterwards.
But there was a suffrage movement in the early 1900s as well, and then there was the Azusa Street revivals, and there was a lot of movement for justice and
a lot of things happening exactly
right
exactly.
Okay.
And then, as you said, it goes dormant. Now, slavery doesn't go dormant. There's still exploitation around the world from the turn of the century into the 90s. But it was really when the Soviet Union collapses, and then people start moving,
right.
Big geopolitical stuff starts shifting,
right.
And people, all journalists and believers and NGOs and governments all wake up to the fact that there is a tremendous number of people who are moving around or actually enslaved right
now. Who wakes up first?
Gosh, journalists, people seeing it on the ground. And
what about artists? I always see that so many revolutions, they trace it back to art.
It's a good question. When we say wake up, what do we mean? Do we mean the people who first sort of see the thing on the ground, or the people who first then bring that realization into the hearts
and awareness.
There's screens of everyday people?
Right. There's awareness, there's communication of the awareness, and then there's hopefully action awareness, which is impact. And if you don't get to the third step, what's the point? It's just a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the leaders in the late 90s, the people who were pointing this out were organizations that already had their sort of finger on the pulse of sort of human rights violations anyway. I first came across this issue because of a group called the International Justice Mission. Who's doing work in the late 90s.
So my friend of mine, his wife, he works here in La Jolla, he's a lawyer in La Jolla, has been wanting to work with them, was a prosecuting attorney for the United States as well. His wife is, who's the guy that started that? It's
Gary Haugen.
Gary Haugen's niece. Mm-hmm. So we're a little bit connected with them. But, you know, IJM. So I was wondering if you knew what they were doing. What do you think of their work?
So IJM was Gary Haugen wrote this book, The Good News About Injustice.
Yes, read
right?
it.
So this is the very beginning, I think, of a newer wave of sort of evangelicals being connected to social justice issues. I mean, Tony Campolo has been doing stuff for a long time. Jim Wallace has been doing stuff for a very long time.
Tony Campolo in Philadelphia and Haiti.
At Eastern, yeah. And so they've been doing this for a long time, but I guess Ron Sider, there's a long history of this in the sort of post-70s evangelical world. But I think that Gary Haugen came in with a sort of newer and fresher response to, I guess, inequality and injustice, and had a very concise and clear message about why it was happening and what could be done. He's a lawyer by training, and his argument is essentially there is a gap in
right.
legal structures. There's a rule of law problem.
Right.
So if we
fix the rule of law
problem, we fix a lot of these other problems.
What tips the scale from awareness to communication to action? What tips that scale? Because there's so many storylines. I'm actually a believer in compassion fatigue. You know, I know that these school shootings happen, that we just had one in Oregon. It did not hit my emotional radar like Columbine did. It did not hit it like Sandy Hook did. Sandy Hook was a new version of it with all young little you know, kids. It's not that I don't have compassion for it. I don't think we were created to be able to handle compassion at that level. I don't think we're supposed to live outside of probably a 3 to 15 mile horseback ride from our house. We're built as agrarian people. So now we're getting overloaded. How do we not have compassion fatigue, and how do we focus on a movement and get it going? What causes that traction?
Well, I think one of the things that caused that traction for the sort of anti-trafficking movement is having a very particular narrative about what the problem is, a clear idea of what the solution is and who it's going to help. And so this is why I think back to Gary Haugen, clear message about it being rule of law.
Storytelling.
And then also, and this helps explain why this issue is taken off, but also I think there's some it gives us something to critique about and something to learn. But the emphasis was also on a particular kind of exploitation, not just on individuals sort of living at the margins or individuals held in slavery,
right.
but trafficked women and children. And so
right.
this becomes a very clear sort of iconic ideal type victim and an ideal type set of human rights violations where we can instantly get our minds around, any of us can instantly get our minds around the fact that serially abused minors, that's a bad thing,
that's
right?
That's a bad thing, right.
Forcing children into degrading sexual acts is a bad thing.
Yes.
Across the board, there's no surprises there. So one thing that helped the movement, the anti-trafficking movement, was this very clear, and I would say very narrow, understanding of what the problem was, which galvanizes all sorts of attention to the issue, because we all agree about that. Now, you get further from that ideal case, and we get to more and more things that fewer and fewer people agree about. And so
right.
this makes it complicated to sustain a movement sometimes. But in terms of getting it going, having that clear message about what the problem is, who the victim is, what the solution is. And I think that, when it's done right, breaks through compassion fatigue.
Yes, I would agree. But people have, it breaks through compassion fatigue because you've narrowed your focus on compassion. I think one of the things the evangelical church needs to do, and organizational leaders, Christian organizational leaders, which is who my main audience is knowing what their message is and being able to share that message regularly in tangible ways. I met a Pentecostal guy one time. He said, you know, we're all about healing. And he says, about every 6 weeks, I got to throw the crutches. I said, what do you mean by that? He goes, I got to bring some up on stage. We got to talk about healing. We got to throw the crutches. And I never forgot that he said, you know, he just had to make it visible. You know, little Timmy living in poverty, you know, in Appalachia or wherever it is, you need to know his name. You need to know who he is. And it's storytelling. And then giving people the tools to jump into that, because you can say, look, I can't fix everything that's going on in Syria right now. I can't take in every immigrant refugee. I can't, you know, if I give a dollar to every cause, I'm going to be broke and nothing's going to be affected that much. But are there ways where I feel this is my calling, this is what I'm about, and to be involved in that? Hey, we're at the AdamStatMiller.com podcast. I'm with, tell me your name, Austin Choi Fitzpatrick. I almost called you Andy.
I'll take Andy.
Professor Austin Choi Fitzpatrick from the USD Center for Peace Studies. It's the Kroc Center for Peace Studies. Really, they do fabulous work. You can check it out. We'll be right back in just a second.